Hi, Michael.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you?
Very good. How are
Good,
you?
thanks. I'm Sarah Posner. I'm Associate Editor of Religion Dispatches, and I'm here today with.
Michael Brendan Doherty. I am a contributing editor at the American Conservative, and I'm happy to be here with you today.
As am I. And we have a lot to talk about, so we'll just jump right in. And I guess we'll get started with talking about Peter King's hearing last week on the extent of radicalization in the Muslim community and that community's response. That was his title. And I was there in the hearing room last week and covered the hearing for The Nation and also wrote a little bit about it at Religion Dispatches. And overall, I mean, I'll just give my general impression and then we can talk about what your thoughts were and maybe get into the particulars a little bit more. But the real takeaway for me, I mean, I think a lot of people focused on the fact that King did not have any actual experts in either homeland security or national security to verify his claim that American Muslims are subject to radicalization in their mosques and community centers, or his claim that they don't cooperate with law enforcement and therefore can't be relied upon to turn in radical members of their community to the authorities. And I think that he offered no evidence of that. But I th the thing that struck me, and I think maybe because I'm a religion reporter and not a national security reporter, was that it seemed to me that it was an effort to portray Muslims as sort of incapable of sorting this out for themselves. In fact, his star witness, Zudi Jasser, framed it as Muslims are not intellectually equipped to deal with these questions, almost like that they're victims of radical Islam and there are no other alternatives for them. And that to me was a sort of a striking thing to sort of just take a whole religion and portray its adherents as not being smart enough to figure this out for themselves. And that to me was really the most stunning theme that emerged from the hearing.
Yeah, I thought that was striking too. I mean, did you get the? I haven't come down on one way or the other, but did you have an opinion whether he was saying that they weren't smart enough, or that Islam, by its nature, somehow, closes that line of inquiry, in one way or another? Not that necessarily, because I couldn't decide exactly where he was coming down on whether it was that Muslims don't do this, or that Islam prevents it, prevent would prevent Muslims from doing it if Islam is taken seriously or followed.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Jasser kind of went back and forth with that. I mean, I think Jasser's testimony and his public speaking engagements in other fora, he sort of elides that particular question because on the one hand, he says, I am a devout Muslim, so I don't read Islam as a violent religion. It's a peaceful religion, and I am a believing and a devout Muslim myself, but the community, like he says, he didn't say it at King's hearing, but he has said it, for example, in Newt Gingrich's movie about Islam that was produced by Citizens United. Jasser says something along the lines of, you know, Muslims don't really have anything to read other than radical stuff. You know, we don't, as a community, we don't produce intellectuals or scholars who give us a peaceful reading of Islam, which is so preposterous that, you know, when I read this back to some officials from the Islamic Society of North America last Thursday who were there at the King hearing, they just laughed because they said, you know, I'd be happy to give him a reading list. So I think that while you could charitably read it as, you know, Islam hasn't produced anything that would give Muslims the tools to read their religion in a peaceful way. I mean, even though that's charitable, it's not even really charitable because it's not true. And I think that you could really take away from Jasser's comments and from the implication of his other witnesses that Muslims don't, you know, they're, you know, for some reason, some unexplained reason, unable to sort all of this stuff out for themselves, to distinguish what the radical stuff that they supposedly hear in their mosques, which, you know, King posits without any evidence, from what Islam truly says.
Right. It's you know, it's funny that he put it that way, because I immediately went back to my own college education, and I remember, you know, Islam course I took at Bard College, and nearly every book was written by a Muslim who was an academic and who was very conscious of talking to people who live in liberal democracies and also to Muslims who do not live in liberal democracies, and, you know, trying to find a way to, you know, to be Muslim in the modern West. And it just seemed like a normal feature of Islamic intellectual life to me.
Right.
The idea that it's totally disappeared. I mean, I can understand that there may be large concentrated populations of Muslims in certain areas that don't read that kind of work. But it is a part of the Islamic world. And, you know, based on my reading, it has been since the beginning, almost.
Well, I think that for a lot of conservatives who try to portray Imam Faisal Abdurrauf, who, you know, was going to be the spiritual leader of the Park 51 Community Center, I mean, he is like as mainstream America-loving, democracy-loving as they come, right?
Right.
And that conservatives attempted to portray him as some sort of secret agent of the Muslim Brotherhood, whose, you know, secret agenda is to subvert the Constitution, I think is indicative that they refuse to acknowledge that there is not only just things that Imam Rauf has written, but, you know, other people have written that demonstrate the compatibility of Islam with Western democracy. And I think that it's also part of this is also that they do not theologically understand the shared values and concepts between Islam and Judaism and Christianity as well.
I think there's that. I always go back when, Islam itself becomes the controversy, to the fact that this seems to just be a feature of American life, is to treat a foreign religion,
quote unquote.
Yeah, quote unquote. I mean, I guess Mormonism would be one of the only native religions.
But still, Mormonism has been demonized.
Oh, yeah,
too,
of course.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And it was at one time foreign to the United States, or seemingly.
Right.
You know, outside the territorial boundaries, at least. But there's this tendency to treat, you know, what you might call foreign ideas as a sort of monolithic ideology, and then even to treat, you know, moderate spokesmen as dangerous because they, you know, open the door to radicals. So you might have, you know, you'd call someone a pinko instead of an outright communist, and, you know, the Red Scare would go after pinkos as well as communists. And so I think it's just a matter of once you decide that some foreign ideas is a dangerous anti-American ideology, and it could be Catholicism, Mormonism, communism, or Islam, you know, there's a, you know, pretty dramatic pushback and a vetting that happens. What I was struck by was just how confusing the hearings were to me. I was watching on television, and it just seemed like a lot of debates about terminology. Are we talking about Islam or Islamism? And it was like a race to give a vocabulary to the public.
It's interesting.
To talk about these issues. And because of that, I found it a little tedious to watch a lot of it, except for, you know, Keith Ellison's testimony was very moving.
Right.
However, I generally don't like that kind of testimony in Congress, you know, because it becomes, the story becomes, you know, a narrative of human drama. You know, it seems like we become a nation of feelings rather than of laws. And I don't like that even when I'm sympathetic to the feelings, as I was listening to Keith Ellison speak. So I found it very odd. And I generally assume good faith on everyone there. It's just it seemed like such a large amount of crosstalk, and I imagine that's how this debate about Islam or radicalization of Muslims might go on for a long time.
Well, I think that there were a few things going on there that might, I hadn't heard anybody, nobody had told me that they had viewed it with confusion like you did, but it's sort of making me rethink what happened that day as I was sitting there. And I think there are a couple reasons for the what you describe as crosstalk. One is that the Democrats, the minority members of the committee, were not on board
Right.
with this hearing. So their purpose was to just undermine the entire purpose of the hearing, to
Right.
question it at every turn, to question why we're not investigating white militias, or, because if there's radicalization in the country that could produce terrorism or has produced terrorism, we should be investigating all of it and not just singling out Muslims. So there was that piece of it. Then there was a piece of it to say to King, as you're saying, what are you talking about anyway? What are we talking about when we're talking about radical Islam? Define
Right.
your terms. And then I think there were a lot of people who didn't know what they were talking about. The people, some of the members of Congress who were doing the questioning. And so I think that that is what produced what you saw as confusing or even tedious and boring. And I have to say, being in the room, there, I think a lot of people were eventually finding it tedious and boring because it
Right.
wasn't. There were no moments for King's part. There was no moment where King could walk out of there and say, "Here was the moment where I finally established what I was trying to establish with this hearing." There was no moment where there was some report or evidence or empirical data that was produced that proved his point. In fact, there was data that disproved his point when Lee Baca, the sheriff of Los Angeles County, testified and talked about how much Muslims in his community do cooperate with law enforcement. So I think that that is probably part of what caused the confusion, is that if King was going to hold this hearing, you were expecting that he might know that his hearing was going to produce something that proved his point, and it didn't at all.
Right. And it also caused a lot of like weird scrutiny of King himself and his past as a very open and forthright supporter of the Irish Republican
Right.
Army, which I thought was interesting. People were pointing out the ironies or trying to fine grain the differences between the IRA and Islamic radicalism. One thing that I thought was interesting that no one seemed to point out was that the IRA was a socialist revolutionary organization.
That's a really interesting point.
And that, there were, far more, there were other Catholic traditional type nationalists involved in, during the 70s and 80s, but it's just interesting that Peter King, being on in the Republican Party, which is gone gaga for the word
Right.
about the word socialism.
Right.
It was just one thing. One thing I didn't see anyone bring up. I don't think it's apropos of anything. I'll just leave it out there. But my thought, though, to kind of sum up my thought on the King hearings was just that this is sort of the awkward, long process of bringing Islam into more of the mainstream of American life, if we can say that it's going there. I think this always happens. The definition of what acceptable religion in America is, has been expanding for 2 centuries, and each expansion is awkward and strange and, the
But
you can
is
even read
there a
things.
parallel in with any other religious group, with what's happening right now with Islam? Is there any parallel where there was an attempt to portray, an extreme act of violence against the United States, 9/11, with an entire religion, right? So, like, I'm thinking back to probably the most Our most recent example, the Kennedy's campaign for president, where he was portrayed as, you know, oh, he might be possibly carrying water for the Vatican when he's in the White House, and the anti-Catholicism that happened during that presidential campaign. But is any of it even remotely, does any of it remotely have the emotional potency that this does? I mean, you know, the Republicans had put up photographs of 9/11 in the hearing room last week. I was sitting right in front of a poster size photograph of the Twin Towers in flames.
Right.
And so, I mean, I'm just wondering, is this kind of a more extreme example because the king and other people who are claiming that the majority of mosques in America are radical and could potentially produce terrorists in the United States, that they have more emotional fodder to exploit with this?
I think there is. I mean, I don't think there's ever been an analogy in American history, as you said, blaming one religion on an act of violence against the United States. But there have been, you know, one thing that comes to mind is in 1834, in Charleston, Massachusetts, there was a mob of Protestants who burned down an Ursuline convent, you know, Catholic nuns. You know, they just had this spasm of violence after there was this young woman, Rebecca Reed, who had attended school with the Ursuline nuns, and then she wrote a pamphlet called 6 Months in a Convent, and, you know, it made kind of accusations about what Catholicism was doing and in America or whatever, and, you know, this mob burned down a convent. And that was before the great wave of Irish migration, you know, later that century. So, you know, in some ways it's worse now, the way Islam is being vetted, because there's just so much more media and it's being done nationally. But I can't think of an instance now where Americans have reacted violently against Muslims in you know, kind of a mob way.
Well, so, there was the highly publicized YouTube video of the protest at in Orange County.
Yeah. Right, but I mean, that never spilled over to arson.
It was all verbal.
Yeah, I mean, people might say that it's kind of hateful and that might be violent, but, you know, it never spilled over to arson.
Right. Although, you know, there have been sort of isolated incidents. There was the stabbing of the cab driver in New York. There was a murder of Sikhs in California recently that's being investigated as a hate crime because frequently there's some confusion among some people about, you know, Sikhs being Muslims because of their
head. No, it's you know, I worry a little bit, you know, I don't want to get too far afield, but I do worry that some of these democratic revolutions going on in the Muslim world, which are releasing some kind of violent energy against Christian churches in Muslim-dominated countries, I do worry that that is going to, you know, fuel the fires over here as well.
Well, I think that there's a tendency to overread those conflicts, say between Muslims and Christians in Egypt or anywhere else, to overread those as an overreaching theological war in which America should engage too. You know, because I get a lot of email from Christian conservative advocacy groups and so on that definitely sort of overread that as, see, Christianity is being persecuted around the world, and therefore this proves that we're locked in this spiritual cosmic battle with Islam. And that's a very dangerous road to go on. I mean, there's obviously no justification for religious or anti-religious violence anywhere, but for Americans to overread that as, you know, America's spiritual war against Islam is a real big mistake.
I hope so. I mean, I hope it's a mistake. I mean, it is tough though when you've had, you know, if you could put yourself in their shoes and say, okay, I believe America is a Christian nation, however I define that, you know, you could find that pretty loosely or pretty strictly. And we were attacked by, you know, radical Muslims. And now I'm watching in Egypt or in Iraq, I'm watching Christian churches getting burned or bombed. You know, I'm watching Christians flee en masse from some countries like Iraq. You know, you can begin to imagine yourself in a world full of conflict. And obviously there's long historical conflict between Islam and Christianity.
Right, but let's flip that over. So, right. You know, at the hearing, after the hearing was over on Thursday, I talked to Richard Kilmer, who's the executive director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And, you know, this is a group of religious leaders who have, you know, for a couple of years now, or maybe going on 2 years now, have really advocated against America's use of torture against detainees and really laid out a religious case against torture. And, you know, he said to me, from the beginning, we understood that torture was motivated by religious ideas that were in opposition to Islam. And so, you know, it's a dangerous path, you know, flipping it either way, it's a dangerous place to go, right? I mean, yes, there is this kind of religion and on religion violence, but I think that it's dangerous for America to frame it that way, because it leads to things like that.
No, I thought it was very wrong when, you know, we didn't get to talk about this back in the day, but, you know, when Bush used the word crusade, mm-hmm. I thought that was a big blunder. And, you know, I thought it was bad when certain U.S. generals have framed it in those terms as well.
And speaking, let's use that as a segue to another topic we wanted to talk about.
Right.
One of the generals or lieutenant generals who did frame it that way was Jerry Boykin, who also served as a team leader on Frank Gaffney's report on the threat of Sharia to the U.S. Constitution and to the United States, which I think was sort of an undercurrent in King's hearing. It might come to the fore a little bit more in future hearings that he holds. That remains to be seen. But at the very end of the hearing, Jeff Duncan, who's a South Carolina Republican, asked one of the witnesses, gave a little speech and asked one of the witnesses a question about Sharia law. And he talked about this whole, you know, idea, this conspiracy theory that Sharia law is a threat to the Constitution and a threat to American democracy. And he cited Frank Gaffney's report. This was the report that came out of the Center for Security Policy back in the fall of 2010. And I think that this has become a really potent tool for anti-Islam, anti-Muslim sentiment here, where they say, well, look, even, you know, even beyond the threat of terrorism and actual violence to the homeland, we have this other threat that's nonviolent and is kind of more secretive and clandestine, and we really have to address that too. And I think that I was a little surprised that it came out at the very end of the hearing as it did in that way, but the fact that it came out at all shows that this does have some potency with the Republicans on the committee and in Congress.
Yeah, there is, you know, it goes back to this idea of ideologizing Islam or whether the question whether Islam is an ideology. And of course that would have, you know, this is the way Sharia is portrayed is, you know, well, this is Islam's march through the institutions, right? You know, what I was interested, you know, it's funny, there was a piece, I think, on your site, I think it was your piece, and you called it the Sharia industry. And I thought that was powerful because I run into educational groups on the right or, you know, just websites that, you know, want to educate Christians or conservatives on the threat of Sharia law, even in the United States. And it's, you know, it's obviously hysterical in the sense that, you know, Muslims are still a vanishing minority
right.
Within America.
I think by Pew just projected that by 2030 there'll be 1.7% of the U.S. population.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and also they're not a particularly politically potent one. They wouldn't be a potent 1.7% either. So I don't know what, I'm still struggling myself to figure out what it is that's attractive about this fear. I don't know.
As far as a conservative, you don't really see, you see it happening, this attempt to portray this in this scary way, but you don't see the appeal.
I don't even know
appeal.
If I think it's a top-down thing. I think there's a market for some of these books.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's tapping into a market that was there, but yeah. It's also, maybe creating a little bit of a market at the same time.
No, that's exactly right. And, I even saw, a little bit of this stuff before 9/11 even. I remember being in college and finding some of this stuff on the web, and there's still groups that felt like the Crusades really weren't over. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out almost psychologically what appeals to people about this fear. The fact is there, on the one hand, there's some little bit of substance to it in the fact that there are Islamic states in the world. And so I think, fear of political Islam is a little more justified than fear of Reconstructionist Christians, taking over the government and reinstituting stoning. There is no stoning in historical Christian countries now. But there is stoning in a few Islamic countries.
Right, but when you talk to experts on Islam, they say those are pre-Islamic practices. Those are not practices that are sanctioned by Islam. And so their argument is that those countries aren't actually implementing what the Frank Gaffneys of the world are calling Sharia law. I mean, Sharia law is more like a, sort of an aspirational, path. As opposed to, it's not, honor killing and female genital mutilation and beheading for apostasy and things like that. Those are not things that are laid out in any Islamic text. These are practices that have been adopted in certain places by people claiming that they're implementing Sharia law, but it's not actual Islamic practices. And the fact that there are some actors have written, for example, one of the documents that the Sharia conspiracy industry points to is a document that was produced and introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation terror financing trial. And it was one memorandum written by one member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was sort of this aspirational document that did not reflect, and I talked to experts on Islamic law, I talked to experts on the Muslim Brotherhood, and this is not something that either lays out what Sharia law is, nor is it indicative of what the actual goals of the Muslim Brotherhood are. Yet, this document has been used ad nauseum as evidence of this supposed plot of the Muslim Brotherhood to use all the Islamic groups in North America, including, ISNA and CARE and the Muslim Students Association and over 200 groups to secretly implement Sharia law in the United States.
Right. I mean, I absolutely agree that this kind of conspiracy theory is really short on facts.
Right. But you're talking about why this might hold some appeal for some people.
Yeah, why it might hold some appeal. And also, I'm also just generally suspicious of, outsiders in Washington or New York trying to tell, trying to say, well, this is true Islam and this isn't true Islam. When we're talking about the Taliban, historically Muslim countries, you know, it's very hard for me to do that. I mean, I agree, you know, obviously female genital mutilation, you know, is obviously something you can trace back to, you know, certain practices in Africa mm-hmm. and elsewhere. And, you know, but stoning was a little bit more universal.
If there are Muslims who advocate stoning, they got the idea from other religions.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's in the Bible.
Right. No, it is. And also it's, you know, I think there's also just a natural, and sometimes this, you don't even have to be a Christian to feel this way, but there's this natural sort of uncomfortable feeling about Islam in that, well, at least Christianity had its first 300 years as a kind of persecuted religion with almost no political ambition, whereas, you know, Islam's history right out of the gate is amazing, fantastic, you know, almost never duplicated military success. And
to the extent that Islam was involved in politics, I mean, you can make the same argument about Christianity, that, you know, Jesus was a political protester. I just don't think you can separate that.
Right. Although that's a very modern, you know, that's, you know, I know Bruce Chilton, my former professor, is kind of leans in that direction too. And there was a lot of hope for that. But the, you know, the first, you know, if you take the first 300 years of both religions, they're very different, you know, or at least the popular imaginations, they're very different. You know, Christianity was still a phenomenon of the urban poor in the Roman Empire for a good long time. Whereas Islam had this kind of dynamic political strength very early.
But I think you could view both as having a prophet spokesperson protesting against the unfair prevailing political elites of their day. You know, in Muhammad's case, it was the Arab world, and in Jesus's case, it was Rome.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's sort of unfair to sort of try to draw some parallel or lack of parallel about the politicization of each religion. I mean, I think that it's impossible to separate them from the political dynamics of their day.
Right. You could. I guess I'm speaking more to the, I'm still trying to find the popular reasons for this discomfort with Islam. I mean,
okay, well,
there's,
you know,
millions
so,
of
so
them.
I think we don't have to go
reasons.
Back that far. If you recall, one of the things that got John McCain in trouble during the 2008 campaign was his association with Rod Parsley, a popular televangelist
right.
who has said Islam is a false religion that must be destroyed. Or go to Jerry Boykin's comments about Islam, that America is engaged in a spiritual warfare with a religion that's satanic.
Right.
So I think that when you have people like that who have big audiences and speak to the, you know, speak to these audiences with much acclaim, that, you know, it's not a huge stretch. You know, like, once you've planted that idea that Islam is satanic, and that it's Christianity's duty to destroy it, there's, you know, there's a lot of bad stuff that can flow from that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because there's, you know, those two phrases you said, Islam is satanic, or, you know, on, and then it's America's duty to destroy it, or it's our duty to destroy it. You know, I'd almost want to separate those out, because on the one hand, there's kind of the banal observation that, well, if I believe my religion is true, then therefore I believe other religions that make exclusive truth claims that conflict with
right.
mine are false. And if I believe religion is a matter of eternal life and death, then we're talking about serious business here. We're not just talking about, you know, some people do a potluck dinner on Wednesdays and some people do, you know, book club on Thursdays. So you know, that's a broader religious issue as well, is just, you know, two of the most dominant religions in the world, Christianity and Islam, are dynamic, evangelical, convert-seeking faiths that traditionally make pretty exclusive claims on the lives of believers, on their minds and actions.
Yeah, but I feel like, you know, someone like Parsley, you know, who is an evangelist, you know, the idea that, I'm sort of losing my train of thought. I mean, the idea that I'm allowed to evangelize and bring my religion to the entire world, but no one else is. I mean, you know, it's this exclusiveness and this triumphalist view of one's own religion.
Right.
That, you know, a lot of American evangelists have.
Right.
And,
I mean,
and so,
do they phrase it in that term of rights? They don't have the right?
I'm not saying they don't have the right to speak their mind or practice their religion or evangelize their religion. But to say that, I mean, I just don't think that that's what Christianity really says. I mean, yes, Jesus did say, you know, go out to all the nations, right? But he also said, love thy neighbor.
Right.
So
Well, and then they would say that, you know, I'm loving my neighbor by, you know, telling him he's in a false religion that'll take him to hell.
Okay, well, we're going to get to hell in a little bit. I mean, we're not going to get to hell. We're going to get to talking about hell in a little bit.
Yeah, we'll say that. But, you know, so, you know, they would say that, you know, it's the loving thing to do is to make Muslims non-Muslims.
Yeah, but maybe you want to ask the Muslims whether they think that's the loving thing.
Right. Well, that's the beginning of the debate. And the Muslims would say the righteous thing is to make Christians into ex-Christians and current Muslims. And you could phrase that in a liberal kind of modern way. And, you know, and you could say, like, well, you know, the truest parts of my Islam were fulfilled in Christianity, or the truest parts of Christianity were fulfilled when I finally embraced Islam. You know, or you could phrase it in combat. I mean, if you want to, one of the dangerous things that, you know, obviously you and I mentioned before, when it comes to Parsley and others, is that, you know, these evangelists seem to want a particular kind of foreign policy from America,
particular kind of government.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
Christian
absolutely
government.
That too. But that sort of, you know, Jesus said, make disciples of all nations, but he didn't say, you know, capture a nation and use the apparatus of the state to destroy the apparatus of other states.
Right.
You know, it's,
thank you for clarifying that.
Oh, no. I don't think it needed clarifying, but.
No, it might need clarifying.
But, you know, you're going to have one thing that modern liberal democracies haven't done, contrary to the secularism thesis, is they haven't truly eroded the truth claims of religion. And I think the nature of Islam and Christianity in particular are going to lead them into conflict. You know, it could be a low-level, friendly, you know, let's get together on Thursday nights at a local mosque or a church and have like a friendly debate and sharing, you know, and people will cross convert the way, say, Catholics and Protestants do in the United States now. Or it could be, you know, something much more geopolitical and frightening.
Well, Let's use this moment to segue to Newt Gingrich, right? Okay, so I'm building up the case for his DVD, America at Risk, The War with No Name. You can't see it, okay?
I know, but I'm going to pretend I can. It looks
foreboding,
great.
Right?
Right.
But so, you know, so he has this DVD out, which, you know, features one of King's star witnesses, Zudi Jasser, and others, you know, talking about how, you know, this threat to America by radical Islam. you know, a lot of it is, the DVD is fairly derivative of other things that have already been produced.
Yeah.
But recently, Gingrich touted his patriotism in a sort of unusual context. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that, not just in terms of the patriotism angle, but also from the angle that, you know, Gingrich is now a Catholic.
Right. Gingrich is now a co-religionist of mine. You know, he, Pope Benedict, Torquemada, and St. Paul and I are all of the same religion. He was asked on the Christian Broadcasting Network about his life and you know, very publicly, Newt Gingrich is on his third marriage. He divorced his first wife on her deathbed. He gave her divorce papers so that he could marry someone he knew professional, you know, from his professional life as a politician. And then he did the same thing again. divorced his second wife for an aide.
Although, to be clear, not on her deathbed, but yeah.
Not on her deathbed, but to be with an aide he had, who's now his wife.
Mm-hmm. Who's 20 years younger than he is.
20 years younger than he is. She seems lovely. And now he's also converted to Catholicism, which is becoming a little bit of a thing. He was asked about these indiscretions, not quite in explicit terms, and he said, listen, you know, there's some things in my life, and then he gave this, I don't have the quote right in front of me, but he said that because of my love of country, I was working too hard, and then some things happened. And people naturally started, you know, Twitter lit up about it. I mean, it was everywhere. It was,
So, you know, he recently launched a presidential exploratory committee.
Yeah.
If he runs for president, I mean, how can he get past this with the Republican base?
I don't think he can. I think there might have been a path, and the path would have been...
it would have been the Ralph Reed path. I mean, Ralph Reed's not divorced, obviously, but he's had some ethical issues, and his path was to fall on his knees and say, you know, I sinned, but, you know, we're all fallen, and ask forgiveness. And
that's the only path. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only conceivable path. People do like a repentant sinner. I mean, I think it's just natural in all of us to, you know, have gone down the wrong path for some time and then needing forgiveness.
How was that consistent with Catholic teaching? Obviously, his divorces aren't consistent with Catholic teaching. And how did he become a Catholic with divorces?
Yeah, no, that actually, I need to look into that because that is truly troubling.
Just to be clear, you know, I don't have an issue with divorce. I have an issue with somebody pretending they're holier than thou and divorcing their wives on their deathbed and calling for the Christian nation, etc., and then doing all of these things.
Right.
But he became a Catholic to much fanfare. You know, he and his wife, one of the other movies that they produced, he and Callista, was a movie about the Pope's role in the fall of communism. And,
right.
You know, so like he's very much touting his Catholic faith and his love of the majesty of the Catholic cathedrals in Europe and how that was very influential in his decision to become a Catholic. So how can you, on the one hand, do that, but also sort of slide by rules that other Catholics have to abide by?
Well, you know, there's two things I want to say. One of the reasons he gets by is because he's kind of famous.
And the church needs
the kind of famous get privileges, yeah, even from the church,
right,
that others don't. On the other hand, on the other hand, there's a part of me that says, as his fellow co-religionist, that, you know, there's some sympathy I have for him in the sense of, you know, St. Augustine wrote, you know, give me purity and give me continence, but not yet. And, you know, so Catholics are still sinners by nature when they come into the church.
But you're saying regular Joe, who had been divorced, couldn't go and say, I'd really like to convert to Catholicism now.
Well, there would be issues.
Okay.
I mean, and I don't know what canonical procedures, Newt has gone through. Obviously his first wife died.
But Okay, so there was no way of like getting an annulment from her after the fact.
Right. Well, and also you were allowed to remarry after death.
But he divorced her before she died, didn't he?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And that would be a very grave sin. I don't know if he got an annulment on the second marriage. I mean, he must have gotten something like that in order for his marriage to be recognized by the Catholic Church, if it is. So I don't know what his, you know, canonical status is, whether it's he's considered to be living in sin with this third wife, but a Catholic, you know, it would, I don't know, but I do believe, and, you know, I don't think it's a particular slight against the Catholic Church. I just happen to think that so many famous people get better treatment from any institution,
well,
just about.
While we're on the topic of the Catholic Church,
yeah.
Last week the Pope issued a statement, which, you know, I kind of caught out of the corner of my eye because I was working on other things, but which was on an issue which I thought had long ago been resolved, and that was that the Jews did not kill Jesus. Can you explain, like, the context in which this statement was made?
Sure.
What's the backstory here with this Pope?
It actually isn't just like a statement. It was, but it was turned into a news item, and here's how. The Pope's book, Jesus of Nazareth, Part 2, Part Duh, is coming out this Lent. I think it's on bookshelves this week. And it deals with the passion and death of Christ. Mm-hmm. And the first book came out, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. And this second book deals with that issue. So he takes up these issues around... you know, scriptural issues about the passion and death of Christ and what it means, you know, who killed Jesus, why did Jesus die, etc. And historically and in the news, etc., there, you know, there's been question of the Jews' responsibility. I mean, and it comes up, it comes up almost whenever people in public talk about the death of Jesus, you know.
But I mean, while it still might come up in those contexts from a scholarly context, hasn't that issue long been settled?
It's long been settled. I mean, you know, the great tradition of Christian theology says that Jesus died for the sins of the world. And, you know, and so that everyone, in a sense, by their sins, has killed Christ. And that he lays down his life willingly. There have been times that passages like... I think it's in St. Matthew's Gospel, when the Jews in the crowd are supposed to have said, his blood be upon us and upon our children. And what do passages like that mean? You know, and there's been this sort of school of thought in and out of the church that, oh, the Jews are somehow especially responsible for rejecting their Messiah, and that there's some kind of blood guilt.
And that this, you know, has been the roots of anti-Semitism since...
Right, it's one of the fonts of anti-Semitism, you know, and it comes up, and sometimes it seems like the sort of orthodox position that Jesus died for because of everyone's sins, or anyone's sins, we could say, and this other blood guilt thing can sort of almost coexist or seem to coexist. You know, Mel Gibson, who's now famous for an anti-Semitic tirade, mm-hmm. When he filmed The Passion of the Christ, he filmed his own hand as being the one putting the first nail in Christ's hands. So it's just an issue. It's covered in this book. And then as pre-release excerpts of the book have been released to the media and the public, America Magazine published that section of a chapter, and then the media picks up on it.
As if it's something new.
As if it's something new, and as if it's something new for this Pope, and they'll say, you know, they phrase it as, well, this Pope's had issues with Jews before because of,
right.
You know, other things in his pontificate, like lifting the excommunications on the Society of St. Pius X,
right.
One of whose bishops.
And that society, they're basically Holocaust deniers, right?
Well, the one bishop in it has, the British bishop, Bishop Williamson, Richard Williamson, seems to be a Holocaust denier and a conspiracy theorist. He's been silenced or supposed to have been silenced by the other bishops in that group, the three other bishops in that group. But the group itself, I don't think you could give them a position on that. And if the group's leader, Bishop Fillet, has said that there's, no basis for, in the Catholic faith, for Holocaust denial, or, it's not part of the Catholic faith, this anti-Semitic stuff. So I don't want to paint that group with a broad brush. I've actually been to some of their chapels, and they seem pretty conventional to me. So there's been issues in the news.
Right, so that's why it becomes sort of an interesting news item, too.
Yeah, I think...
So I was right to think when I saw it out of the corner of my eye that this is nothing new.
Right, it's nothing new. I mean, it was also... there have been issues that when Pope Benedict released the traditional Mass, that, there's a Good Friday prayer, especially for the conversion of the Jews. That was a news item at the time. So the media has a kind of interest in the Pope and the Jews type of stories. And this was just another one. But it's a very small part of the book. And, it is a little bit of a nothing burger.
Well, let's move on to another sort of theological thorny theological question, and that is what happened recently with the evangelical pastor Rob Bell, who has suggested that perhaps there isn't a hell.
Right.
And he's actually not the first evangelical to say this. I mean, several years ago when Carlton Pearson, who at the time was a very prominent neo-Pentecostal televangelist who really got his start from Oral Roberts and Oral Roberts University, he suggested this idea that there wasn't a hell, and that if God was a loving God, he wouldn't consign anyone to hell. And he was, essentially excommunicated by the dollar, if you know what I mean. I mean, he basically lost all of his financial support for expressing this universalism. And, evangelicalism doesn't have a Vatican, so there isn't really any actual excommunication, right? And I'm wondering, so with Rob Bell, there was not an excommunication, but...
There was a Twitter storm.
Twitter storm, exactly, which is like the new way of addressing...
That's a really interesting angle on this, too, is that... heresy within evangelical circles is handled very differently.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would that be handled in the Catholic Church? I mean, there's no Catholic priest who could say what Rob Bell said, right?
No, I mean, you could say, if you phrased it in a certain way, you might be able to slyly get away with it. But no, eventually your books would be banned from being taught as Catholic theology in Catholic universities and seminaries. The Pope might, or the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, which is the successor office to the Holy Office or the Inquisition, would ask you to shut up kindly. So it's just a feature of Protestantism that you don't have that. There's no desire for an official
especially
hierarchy.
Non-denominational evangelicalism.
And it's magnified by the fact that we have these non-denominational movements. And so, and because of the history of Protestantism, there is a kind of feeling of standing up to church authority can be heroic.
Right.
In a way that's...
So
it's
this
much
is
more
Rob Bell's nailing the theses on the wall.
Exactly.
On the door, sorry.
And there was a controversy about 15 years ago, I think, or less than 15 years ago, about openness theology, and Clark Pinnock and other evangelical theologians were saying essentially that God had no foreknowledge, that God did not know the future, and that his plans change according to our prayers or whatever. And it ended up being hashed out. The reaction wasn't quite as fierce as the reaction against Rob Bell, but it ended up being voted on in the Evangelical Theological Society, which, utterly condemned it. But this was just condemned immediately on Twitter, and You know, I saw Pastor Douglas Wilson, who's a pretty well-known Reformed theologian in Moscow, Idaho. You know, he put up a video, you know, like a vlog, in which he criticized Rob Bell not just for heresy, but for being a zeitgeist sniffer. Which I
thought was one of the best. That's a great term.
Yeah, it was one of the best phrases I've ever heard. And it's actually a little bit true for Rob Bell, too. You know, he does, you know, look to write about sex or other things in a way that, you know, is definitely provocative and definitely seemingly calculated for media attention.
But I think that this is a struggle, I think, within evangelicalism as it has embraced the, you know, sort of the mega, the hip, you know, wear your jeans
Absolutely.
And your Hawaiian shirt megachurch model. Because on the one hand, it's, you know, fun and hip and there's great music and dancing and, you know, we're not, you know, dancing fearing fundamentalists anymore and, you know, it's all very sort of touchy feely. But there's only so far that will go. That there's still this discomfort with challenging certain theological ideas, certain fundamental theological ideas like the existence of hell.
Right. And it's interesting because there seems to be
Did he
a
say
kind
there was
of...
no sin? He didn't say there was no sin.
No.
Yeah.
What he, you know, what's interesting is his, you know, the book's called Love Wins All or
Love Wins, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Love Wins. And, you know, he does admit sin, but, you know, focuses on the more universalist sounding passages, you know, that Christ died for the sins of the world, you know, not just for the sins of Christians or something like that, that seem to be in there. And, you know, just kind of puts away the other stuff. What's interesting to me about this, as a Catholic and a Christian, I guess I could say, is that, you know, Jesus is the figure in the Bible that talks about hell the most by far. I mean, no one's even remotely close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, St. Paul never even uses the word. He uses words about the wrath of God, etc. But Jesus is the one talking about flames that never go out, etc. So, I mean, Rob Bell's really kind of balling out with this one. And, you know, there seems to be one thing that I think is interesting. You know, I mentioned Pastor Douglas Wilson. There does seem to be a kind of generational whiplash within evangelicalism because, you know, these hip churches, they're often thinking, okay, the church I grew up in, why does that repel so many people? Why does my church or my style of Christianity that I grew up with, why doesn't it attract people? And then they begin to try to change it, you know, maybe first in the style. So it's like we'll have coffee shops or whatever within the
mm-hmm.
church. And then maybe later in the theology. But then there's also a whiplash back. Pastor Wilson himself came up in sort of the Jesus movement of the 70s, which was, you know, theologically.
Right. I know lots of people who came in that and are kind of more in that Wilson camp, you know? It's like,
yeah, and now he's like
yeah.
the leading exponent of like Calvin
exactly.
style
Calvinist
Reformation.
Now.
Right.
But then,
so,
but,
you know, it's just kind of interesting the way that happens. I mean, you know, obviously both Wilson and Bell would say, you know, I'm following the Holy Spirit here.
Well, I think,
you know.
I think that Bell has critics, and I'm not at all being critical of Bell. I mean, you know, if he wants to be a universalist, I have no dog in that fight.
Right.
But he has his same generation critics. I think he's probably the same generation as Mark Driscoll, the Seattle pastor, who's, you know, really been critical of Bell, not just over this, I think, just in general.
Yeah, I think it's generationally, what I meant by that is it's generationally on the individual
level.
Oh,
I see, that they're, yeah.
Yeah, not that these, you know, happen in spurts, but I think it's individual. So, if you know, as an evangelical, if you grow up dissatisfied in a kind of conservative church, you might find a way to be in a more liberal church yourself.
Right.
And then you call it a movement
or
that you're leading.
Reverse.
And then
yeah.
you do it the other way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because it complicates the story a little bit of, you know, for 10 years or more now, there's been this kind of dominant theme of the new Orthodox or the new traditionalists, you know, and that all mainline Christianity is dying and all kinds of liberal Christianity is fading out. It seems like conservative Christianity will still be a wellspring for liberal Christianity, you know, will still be a source of converts to liberal Christianity for a long time to come. Or for, you know, I don't even know if you want to call Rob Bell liberal.
You know, I wouldn't call him.
It's hard to categorize a term like the universalist position as liberal or conservative. I mean, some people would say it's, you know, I guess it goes back to origin in the 3rd century, 4th century. You know, so it's as old as Orthodoxy, but.
Well, I think we might have to continue this discussion at another time.
Right.
Because we've kind of, I think, gone probably past the amount of time.
That's right.
But that's okay. But I'm sure we're going to talk about the existence of hell again. How could we not talk about hell again?
No,
right?
It seems, you know,
it seems inevitable that we will discuss it again.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, my feeling is I look around the world and I think if God is just, there must be a hell somewhere.
Interesting.
But hopefully we won't all go there. And on that note, that's perfectly note.
Well, it was, you know, this was a really interesting, wide-ranging conversation, and I'm really glad we had a chance to do it and hope we can do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you so
much,
Sarah.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.